Award-winning journalists Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner join us this morning to discuss their new book, High Crimes, The Corruption, Impunity, and Impeachment of Donald Trump. The book offers the most comprehensive inside story behind our most significant modern political drama, the House impeachment of Donald Trump. Having spent a year essentially embedded inside several House committees, the two draw on many sources to expose the politicking, play-calling, and strategies debated backstage and to explain the Democrats' successes and apparent public failures during the show itself. Again, the new book is High Crimes, The Corruption, Impunity, and Impeachment of Donald Trump. It is a great pleasure to welcome Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner to the roundtable. I believe I have one of you, not the other, but I don't know which one I have.
Well, it's Michael here.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm great. Good to be with you.
Great to have you back on the program. Always nice to have you. All right. Let us begin by talking about, and I think Peter will be joining us momentarily, what is it that brought you to the subject of wanting to embed yourself into these hearings and to find out more about what went on?
Well, I think the idea began with an outreach I received. You know, this is how these things work. There was a man who I actually went to high school with, who's now in D.C. and circulates among a lot of members of Congress and people in the administration. And he knew a couple of the committee members on the House Judiciary Committee. He called me soon after the Democrats won control of the House in 2018. And he said, you know, I think you ought to talk to these couple of fellows. Something is going to happen. We don't know what it is, but something's going to happen. And at that time, Robert Mueller's investigation was underway. It was really the only game in town for those who wanted to hold Trump accountable for any of his acts, because up until the Democrats seizing the House, there was no body with the authority to investigate. And so when this happened, I went down for a few meetings, and we just stuck with it. I'm based on Long Island, and Peter Eisner, my partner, is based in D.C. We actually put together a little team of journalists and stringers, and were determined that no matter what happened, we'd be on top of the story so that by the time Election Day rolled around, we'd be able to produce a book, and lo and behold, we did it.
Peter Eisner joins us now. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
So Michael was just talking about what brought you to take on this project. So let me continue with you as to when you do something like this, of what step one is. Michael was talking about, you know, the embedding and having many reporters working on it, but I guess one of the questions I have is, how much could ask both of you this, but did you think at any time that this could lead to the impeachment of the president?
To the impeachment, Joe, yes. Because the impeachment just involved,
right,
a majority of members of the Democratic-held House to vote in favor of it.
And then so, removal, yes, from office.
Removal from office, I think that was a very distant hope. I mean, the only thing that possibly could have led to removal was some kind of snowballing effect from the accumulation of lies that brought so much public pressure to bear on the Senate that would force Republicans to do that. But Mitch McConnell was not about to let that happen. And I don't really think that any of the hard-boiled members of the Democratic side, either in the Senate or in the House, really thought that to be the case. I think that Michael and I really felt that we saw them as the Democrats as taking this as a moral responsibility, regardless of the fact that Trump would be acquitted of the charges.
When you think about the actual charges, so let's go back to the phone call. The whistleblower sounds the alarm on what the president eventually referred to as the perfect call. So then what happened from there? Give us a timeline, Michael, of basically from that call of when the alarm bell started to go off.
Well, one of the really compelling elements of the story that I think we tell better than anyone else because we've had access to whistleblowers' lawyers is the great lengths that official went to try to follow the rules, to try and keep whatever national security concerns were at play secret, and to follow the process that's established within the intelligence community to raise a concern. But this person who was one of the official listeners to the perfect call, so this is a process that people may understand, but both in the Situation Room at the White House and also in secure settings elsewhere, specialists listen to every phone call the president has with head of state and often with other high-level foreign officials. And they are there primarily to protect U.S. interests, not to monitor the president. You know, it doesn't occur to people that he might break the law by soliciting help from a foreign power in an election. I think these are routine matters. Reports are written. It's not a transcript that's produced. And that's another thing that the president sort of muddied the waters on. He would go around saying, read the transcript, read the transcript. Well, there was no transcript. There was a readout, a report on what these folks heard. And it was alarming enough that the whistleblower first reached out to the inspector general and to the officials in the chain of command that eventually leads to Congress when such a concern is raised. And during that time, there was a great deal of fear. This person would telephone his attorney, and the attorney would literally drive in circles, sometimes driving in circles around the White House to avoid being overheard, to avoid the possibility that his office phone might be tapped. I mean, this is very heady stuff, very serious. And so when the proper process didn't work, when things got stuck within the security establishment, because the Justice Department, again, this is another instance of William Barr overstepping the normal process, the Justice Department tried to head off a report to Congress. The attorney walked the report directly to the relevant committees, and that was in mid-September, and that pretty much sealed the deal. Once Congress, and especially the Democrats who controlled the House Intelligence Committee and related committees, were aware of what was going on, they were then empowered to begin a more serious investigation. And the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was part of that process. And we have a very nice little story in the book about her decision-making and the day when she announced that there would be a formal impeachment inquiry. It then takes on a pretty dramatic and rapid narrative pace.
When it comes to Paul, I want to talk about some of the people involved here and the role that you write about that Paul Manafort has is fascinating and well, and quite frankly, a little scary. So give us a sense of Peter, of where Paul Manafort comes into the story.
Well, the important thing that we wanted to emphasize in the book was that Paul Manafort was engaged with Ukraine and Russian intelligence connections for more than 10 years. As a matter of fact, one of the people that testified before the House Intelligence, William Taylor, who had been ambassador and then left the State Department, and then came back after Masha Yovanovitch was fired by the president and became acting ambassador. There's a lot more that he knew about what Manafort's connection had been that didn't even come up in the course of the impeachment inquiry. Taylor, as ambassador in 2008-2009, was receiving unsolicited visits from Paul Manafort, who was working on behalf of Russian-supported Ukrainian officials that was trying to sell the United States with the idea that this was all a great enterprise, and that Ukraine and the United States would have a great connection and such. And eventually, the meetings not only with Manafort, but with one of Manafort's Ukrainian / Russian intelligence contacts, Dmitry Firtash, was part of a long time Russian operation on the one hand, and as we also point out, this had a lot to do with the gas and oil business that Russia and Ukraine and Russian oligarchs and the mafia were involved in. The United States was inserted into the middle of that, and there were people making money on this.
Well, I think the other thing that's very scary about all of this is that Manafort was behind the authoritarian regime that ran Ukraine from around 2010 until the dictator was driven out in the Maidan Revolution. And these were very scary people. This is an environment where political assassinations were fairly frequent. The regime killed more than 100 protesters. And we tell a story about how on the day that Manafort was playing a starring role in the nomination of Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention, he gets up in the morning to go do an interview with ABC News, and on the very same morning, 5,000 miles away in Ukraine, one of the enemies of the regime gets in his car, drives down the street, and it explodes and kills him because a bomb had been planted by the side in the political war in Ukraine that Manafort worked for. And he also, you know, was the guy identified in the infamous black ledger of accepting more than $12 million from these folks and keeping it off the books and not paying taxes on it. Sort of like Al Capone, he got caught mostly for taxes. But this is how really bloody and dangerous these games are, and yet he posed as Donald Trump's campaign chairman as just a regular old political operator, and he's far from it. His record of working for human rights violators and violent kleptocrats around the world is well established.
Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner are our guests. Their new book is High Crimes, The Corruption, Impunity, and Impeachment of Donald Trump. The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books. So as we continue, let us talk for a moment about the Democrats and what they were up against here in trying to get the information. Obviously, a lot of stonewalling. At what point did... Give us some sense of the information that they were able to get and information that still was out of their reach, even though they perhaps knew it existed.
Well, part of the problem was that the ability of a House committee to do investigations has really been diluted over recent years, mostly because under Republican control, the budgets for investigators were quite low. So it's shockingly evident that the committees, the House committees, had to rely a lot on news reports, news leaks that were coming in alternately to the New York Times and the Washington Post on the one hand, and also to rely on the blueprint that the Mueller report had already put together. And these things changed, and the ability to focus on things changed very quickly. It became clear when the Mueller report came out that their attempt, that is the Democrats' attempt in the House to expect and to use Mueller as a real tying point to challenging Trump, was obviously usurped by William Barr, who came out and gave a misleading and false narrative of what the Mueller report had in it. And they felt that that being members of the House Intelligence Committee and the House Judiciary Committee, felt they'd been cut off at the pass and unable to attack the central points that Mueller was making. A, that although the word collusion was not actually a legal term and Mueller wasn't looking at it, there were hundreds of strange contacts between the Trump campaign and Russians. And as Mueller says in his report, had he been able to investigate further, had documents not have been destroyed, emails not have been destroyed, and had people not lied, and in parentheses, had he had the time to interview Donald Trump, the result might have been different in terms of what the Trump campaign's relationship with Russia was. Mm. The second part of Mueller was, of course, looking at Trump's blocking of the ability to investigate. You know, and so these things were at the start were where the House wanted to go, and they were worried that they were not going to have the public going along with them as they did this inquiry.
When it comes to the overall hearings and the case, what was it that what did the Democrats think they were up against, and what were they actually up against? I mean, were they the same thing, or were there surprises for them, Michael?
Well, you know, I think that they understood from the start that they were going to be stonewalled. So they were up against the very strong resistance in the administration to anyone testifying. And actually, I think when the accounting was done at the end of this whole process, the House discovered that not one single piece of paper that had been requested by these investigating committees was ever turned over. So they faced this terrible prospect of going into the courts to try and force the release of these materials. That could take years. You know, this is how the system works, is presidents often complete their term and maybe even serve another one before these disputes with Congress are resolved by the courts. But I don't think that they understood that many private citizens and would also resist, people who had been either had retired from the administration and gone on to other things or had been fired, some of them, they refused to come and testify voluntarily. So they ran into that problem. And then there was this turning point. And later members of Congress told us that this was really the thing that was sort of the last straw, when Corey Lewandowski, who had taken over, who had been a campaign chairman before Manafort took over, and is this very pugnacious guy, sort of a mini Donald Trump in performance mode, shows up and testifies to the Judiciary Committee in the House and really spends the entire time mocking the process, resisting, repeating ad nauseum that he's been advised by the White House not to respond to certain questions, when the White House had no authority to advise a private citizen on what he could address and what he couldn't address. And the longer this went on, the more the members of Congress who were watching in their offices, because these things were televised, got angry about this. And people who had been sitting on the fence on impeachment, who thought, well, you know, I'm in a purple district where I just barely won election the last time around. I'm not sure I want to go out on a limb attacking the president and seeking impeachment. They decided they were all in. So this was a moment of resistance when it backfired for the Trump folks, where they got much more than I think they expected in response from the House. And I think also when Speaker Pelosi made the decision with the fact that these swing district Democrats were coming on board, she understood that she could then perhaps persuade the country that this was the right thing to do, that investigating what became the Ukraine scandal was required and that impeachment should be considered. And as things proceeded into the fall, the majority of Americans agreed with her and said, at the very least, there should be an investigation and perhaps impeachment of the president.
Peter, we're just about out of time, but I'm curious as to, with 2 weeks to go before the election, how much this resonates even with voters, those who haven't voted yet, and the fact that this was less than a year ago, and yet it seems 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, we think of it. Yeah, it feels like ancient history. Look, the Trump has been successful in flooding the zone with so much information and so many lies, as my former colleagues at the Washington Post said, you know, more than 22,000 Pinocchios and counting every day. It's very hard to hold him down to anything and to know even what to focus on. There's weariness and about it all. But what we feel is that we can't normalize it. We have to take a look at the full gamut of what happened here. And there's three parts to it. One is Ukraine was much worse than the House even led on because they wanted to keep it simple. Two is the idea of actually impeaching him was a difficult step. And I think they actually got through it well. One of the main problems that Pelosi had was how will the American people react to this versus all of the other things that they're facing? They weren't facing COVID yet, but they were facing concern about health care. Mm. They're facing concern, all sorts of domestic concerns. I think they got through it well. But as we go toward the election, what we're really doing is facing this as one more reason to question who was Donald Trump and is this what you wanted in your president?
The name of the book is The Corruption, Impunity, and Impeachment of Donald Trump. High Crimes is the title of the book. That's the subtitle, The Corruption, Impunity, and Impeachment of Donald Trump. It is by Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner. The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books. Michael and Peter, I thank you very much for spending time with us. Best of luck.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, High Crimes. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.